Now, Jeff, all in the background right. talking, is that an issue with that?
No, we're all good, and I really, really want to thank you for taking the time, and we're going to start now, and I'm super excited to have Bert Soren with us today. The reason I asked Bert is a few months ago I got a great opportunity to actually meet you in person, and I was very, humbled by the fact that you guys were so warm and welcoming, and for those of you that are not familiar with the Soren family, you're talking about a family that has a great history of being some of the greatest pioneers in strength training, especially in the recent, probably, 50 years or so?
Yeah, we've been around. Oh, first of all, thank you for having me here, Josh. I really, really appreciate it. It was great to meet you a couple months ago at the open house, and it was awesome to have you here and showing us a lot of things with the sandbags and different ways to train. It's great to have minds from different places and different backgrounds get to come together. But I do appreciate the opportunity to speak with us. As far as Sorenex, we've been around for 28 years as a company, but my father, Richard's been in the strength and conditioning industry and really making his own stuff since mid to late 60s, which would make him about 14 or 15 years old. So he's been pretty dyed in the wool and been all about it for a long time.
And, my main motivation was, what I love about your company so much, it's not a company that just tries to make equipment and then tries to, convince athletes to use it. You guys are athletes yourselves, and it's probably, maybe you can speak a little bit about, what goes on into the development of the equipment that you guys produce and what your thought processes are, because I'm sure you make it for somewhat of yourself in mind, because you have quite an athletic career yourself.
Yeah, and absolutely, and that's really how everything started. I would say in the late 70s and early 80s, when we kind of became a company, my dad, Richard, was an Olympic lifter himself and getting into some powerlifting and just has always been a lifter. And he really told me, he said, I just couldn't find equipment that was built very strong, but also being an innovator, and he's just always been kind of a machinist, he said nothing was ever really nice and custom and ways that I would want it if I was to buy it. And so really he saved up some money and bought a welder and started building the equipment right there in his garage, and he would sell a little bit to a church or a rec center, and then once we would make a little bit of money, he'd buy a drill press or buy one more little tool, and just really built it about as grassroots as you could possibly get. And it was always for the athlete or for the lifter by the lifter, and it was never looked at as a corporate model or something that was really to try to make money on. It was always just as a passion of loving to innovate and build things, and being an athlete that always wanted to be stronger. And from some of his background and just love of the sport, he was on one of the first groups that brought some of the Russians over to the U.S. in the mid-80s to give us some of their training ideas. And he was on the short list of athletes and coaches who were, in many cases, some of the legendary pro coaches today. All when they were young bucks, they pulled their money together and brought some different coaches over here so they could learn more about strength training. And it's a lot where a lot of our ideas of training came from, and it's always been about that. So, as athletes and current athletes ourselves, that's really where everything is stemmed from.
And, for those that are somewhat unfamiliar, your father is probably best known for being the first man to close the number three. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say so. He was the first certified captain of Crush, which is mm-hmm. the Iron Mind number three gripper. You hear a lot of people just say the number three. but it was... I guess he first closed it in the mid-80s when it was thought to be an impossible thing to accomplish as a human, when no one was even really close. And there really wasn't grip training. It was not in the forefront or even in the on the back burner of even, fringe strength training at the time. No one was doing it. And Dad really thought it was really cool, and it was because of a lot of the stuff he read about Hermann Görner, one of the German strongmen of yesteryear, and just some old books he'd read, and just thought that some stuff written by Terry Todd about grip training. And so he got into it, started doing the anvil lifts, and invented the blob lift, and closed the number three gripper, and that was before they even had any certification or anything. So in 91, he officially certified as the first guy to do it, and it's been kind of a milestone and a something that a lot of the strongest in the world have strived to do as a milestone in their strength career.
Now, what motivated him? I mean, obviously you mentioned some of the great classic strongmen, but, you know, obviously with a background in Olympic lifting, what was intriguing to him about grip training? I mean, because some people may look at it as sort of a circus act rather than
sure.
a strength-building tool.
Sure, sure. Well, since Dad was a little kid, he always had really, really strong hands. You know, he would even play when he was a little kid. His mom used to always say, God, your hands are so strong, you know, and my grandmother used to talk about that. And he used to read a lot of the Strength and Health magazines and a lot of the writings by Terry Todd. I think Mighty Mitts was the article, and it was in the early 60s probably where they talked about pinch gripping two 45-pound plates together and things that were the Jowett anvil, things that were really seen as strength feats. And from a historian like Terry Todd, who was in the York stable under Bob Hoffman at the time, it was a really interesting thing to Dad. And, you know, he was a little kid and read all the time and just thought it was sounded really, really cool. And, you know, kind of the romance part of it, just thought that's what he wanted to do even from an early age. And started playing with it and just realized he excelled. And I believe I have a picture of him when he was 12 or 13 lifting two 35-pound York plates face-to-face with his right
wow.
hand and two 25s in his left. A 12 or 13-year-old kid, probably 100, 110 pounds body
amazing.
Weight. And so, I mean, it was interesting. I was in college before I could do that, and I'm thinking, wow, Dad was doing that when he was a little kid. And who would even know to do that, which was the funny part. Like, so that was just really interesting. He's always kind of walked to his own beat. And then in the 80s, he realized that he had a gift for it and really just kept pushing it. And the biggest, I guess, appreciation I have for the whole thing is not the actual physical strength he's had in doing it, but just the forethought to realize to be one of the pioneers and to even try. When everyone thought that number three was unclosable or the blob was unliftable, this thing that he just kind of played with in his garage, he kept doing it until he did it. And a lot of other people have seen the blob. I know the first time that John Brookfield was the first time he came to our facility. He saw the blob sitting on the floor, and he tried to lift it so many times. Finally, he ran up and kicked it, thinking that we had played a trick on him, and bolted it down to the ground because he said, hey, there's no way that's that hard to pick up. And Dad said, oh, I tried it thousands of times before I ever picked it up. And it just amazes me to think that you're your own guy. You're sitting in your garage thinking that thing is liftable like an Excalibur, you know, sword out of a stone, and not even knowing if it's doable, but you're going to do it until you get it. And it's still, even today, with some of the strongest in the world, it's still a very viable grip strength feat. So it's kind of comes back to, like, you know, the first guy ever to eat an oyster. You know, that guy had, he had to kind of think of what he was doing, you know. And so to even tackle some of these grip feats, I just have a lot of respect just for the forethought.
Now you're a little different, though. I mean, you compete worldwide in Iron Games, and
yes.
You have a great background in specifically the hammer, right? And
yes.
I mean, is this type of stuff applicable for other athletes, or is it mostly just a strength?
The strength training itself, I would say. I came from a career as a collegiate All-American in the hammer throw at University of South Carolina. And then competed in two Olympic trials in 2000, 2004. And after that, I kind of went into semi-retirement. And Highland Games had always been a cross-training type event for me, just a few weeks out of the year, until about 06, where I decided to take it a little bit more seriously and had a little bit better career. And then I recently turned professional and been invited to some bigger games and won the Amateur World Championships last year in 07. So it had a good run, and I'm still getting better at it, which is really nice because I get to kind of relive a whole new career because I'm getting that addictive increase in performance that's so nice when you first start a sport, you know. So I'm still getting to enjoy that. But as far as the training protocol for other strength athletes, you're working with a lot of the similarities that you'll find in many other strength sports, which is going to be core strength, functional mobility, just overall just power production and acceleration of an implement, and a lot of grip strength. You know, I can't say that I hold a candle to Dad's grip strength. I have very strong hands, but in all honesty, I do almost no grip training right now in season because my hands are constantly beat up from just all the throwing. Just the tendons and ligaments and everything in my hands and wrists are just pretty much killing me at all times right now. But
so, sure.
So the even to think about trying to close a 3 or even a 2 right now, whether I could do it or not, it just sounds so painful. I don't even want to pick it up. Probably a lot like a lot of the strongman training would be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and then you know, you mentioned earlier the influence that the dealing with some of the Russian information that you guys had exposure to. You know, there's such a feeling of mystery and almost exclusivity with it. You know, what was some of the stuff that you got firsthand opportunities to
sure.
learn some of this stuff? Well, what's some of the stuff that made an impact on you?
Well, some of that was very interesting, and that was the idea of training everything at a high rate of speed. And you're talking about in the late 70s, early 80s, when most everything were still revolved around the slow and controlled mindset, or the more weight mindset, which is so prevalent in America right now. And it was kind of interesting that from that information, I came home from my, the typical 8th grade weightlifting class when I was a kid, and I told Dad, I said, well, the coach told us to do it this way. I was showing him how to bench press, and it was, doing it slow and controlled and all this. And Dad said, well, that's good and everything. He said, but tell me a sport that it's better to be slow, and I'll tell you why you should lift slow. And I remember that my entire life, and I still haven't come up with a sport that you're actually better at if you're slower. And
right.
So with that mindset, it's always been about the acceleration of the implement or the person or manipulating a person or implement faster. So obviously the Russians were pretty keyed in on that and to training for a range of speed and weight, which, it isn't anything groundbreaking right now, but 20 years ago that was pretty shattering. And just as far as stability, a lot of things being ground-based, not necessarily sitting down on machines. What really it boiled down to, in speaking with Al Miller and a couple of the other professional strength coaches who were all in on that first ground floor with bringing the Russians over, they said it really came down to a couple components, which I've tried to kind of base my training around, which is the reversibility of an athlete to be able to go from concentric to eccentric and back as fast as possible, to be able to change that direction, decelerate as fast as possible, and reaccelerate. You'll see in many athletes, they never reach top speed. They never reach that 40-yard sprint speed that you'll see that all the NFL coaches are looking for. But there could be superb running backs because they're able to decelerate and accelerate so quickly that they never reach top speed, but they're able to cover as much ground as possible, which is many change of direction. That's what makes them so hard to catch. It's not that straightaway speed. But then also the power production in the first 0.02 seconds,
mm-hmm.
which is just, again, and a lot of that is genetic and a lot of that is training, but to be able to train for that is how you're going to get the most out of those genetics. And really, those are kind of the two main things we've really based our training around, because if in almost all sports, if you can't accelerate in that first 0.02 seconds and then be able to decelerate as quickly as possible and re-engage, that's the difference between your college and your NFL athlete. I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to.
Well, it's an interesting thing. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think it's too basic, because I think, we'll spend a couple minutes just talking about this, because I think it's a fascinating topic. You know, I've had an opportunity to speak with people. I don't know if you're familiar with Jay Schroeder.
Sure.
But, his implementation may be different. He may be seen as a little more extreme, but it's a lot of the same concepts.
Absolutely.
Maybe
Jay is on the bean on many things. I mean, as far as he has some pretty extreme ways to go about getting that and in some controversial ways, but I really respect a lot of what he's doing because he's thinking outside of the box, and he's trying to find out ways to really tweak those last couple RPMs out of each athlete, which, again, if you're working with that speed aspect and then the microseconds it takes to decelerate and accelerate back, that's where you got to be a lot of times.
Well, how do you guys go about it? I mean, I'm sure everyone, you know, you could sell someone a theory and you'll have five different coaches come up with five different ways to implement it. But how do you go about,
Well, and a good point that you just made, you know, you might have five different coaches come up with five different theories, and it's not to say any of them right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything works to an extent, but nothing works all the time.
Right.
And that's something that I've had to realize in my training as well. People say, well, write me a workout, or, you know, I've used your ARC training system or something like that. And I said, yeah, the whole point of why it works is because it changes a lot.
Right.
And, you know, you have to be able to work different components. And to change enough. I mean, some of our workouts are dirt, simple, basic, vanilla, but in 2 weeks they're going to be off the wall crazy. And that's why I think we've been able to make some pretty good increases with some different athletes. But as far as we do a lot of stuff with the Tendo machine to gauge speed, and a lot of it is more the intent of the speed. It's not necessarily the actual speed that's produced, because some people just aren't as gifted as others. But to tap into the intent of the speed, I think, is the main thing. And that's really when my training changed in college, with the intent, regardless of the actual load of the weight. That's when things really started to fly further.
So do you measure more of a percentage drop-off or actual force production? What numbers are you more concerned with when you're training? Because for those that don't know, the Tendo unit is a very simple tool to hook up to a barbell or some equipment and measure force output. And you can even set it to compare by repetition, correct?
Exactly, correct. And it's going to tell you a percentage, say, if rep 2 was 92%, that rep 1 was. And then you might jump back up to 97, and it will just go back and forth. But sometimes we'll do some things as simple as, we'll go step ups. I'll pick usually my weak leg, because, you know, I try to be balanced as possible, but I know one leg is weaker than another. Mm-hmm. Strangely enough, it's my right leg, although I'm right dominant. But I think it was due to improper rehab on an old knee surgery. And also, I think due to my sport, I post up on my left leg so much. In short ranges of motion, my left leg is stronger than my right. You know, it's just one of those kind of hazards of the game. You kind of learn it after a while. But anyway, I'll go to my left leg. We'll do, like, say, an explosive step up using bands on each shoulder. That way you have the intent of trying to push as hard and jump off the box as hard as possible, but the band is holding you down. So I'll start that way. I might go a set of four. I'm trying to get it around 4 to 5 to 6 reps, somewhere in there. But what I'm actually doing is I push as hard as I can until I fall below 95 or 93%, whatever I've prescribed that day as the percentage drop off. And then I'll match it with my strong leg. So I found it works pretty well. And then again, you're trying to blast it as hard as you possibly can. They're bringing back the intent, not just, okay, I want to do 4 reps today. As most athletes, they could cruise through a workout that's a 5x5 just because it's just work. You know, I can make 225 look hard, or I can make it look real easy. It just depends on the speed. But if you're really trying to smoke the speed and trying to break the bar, it's going to tax you a lot quicker, and you're going to get much more efficient workouts, because they're going to be a lot quicker. You're not going to be able to hold that huge amount of volume at that high intensity.
Now, you guys have worked, obviously, with a lot of professional and collegiate teams. Is there a way to adapt that concept to, let's say, a large group, or even someone who doesn't have the advantage of using the Tendo unit?
Yeah, and actually, we've worked a couple different ways. I don't know if you're familiar with that ARC training system that Chris West from UConn basketball, he kind of came up with a concept, and I've changed it slightly to use, and ARC just stands for auto regulation conjugate method. And what we use is the Tendo every day in training. And we have a series of tests, and usually it's just one test, 2 sets of 4, and either a hang snatch at 50 kilos, a squat jump at 50 kilos. And we've toyed around. We're trying to find what the third exercise would be. We've tried explosive push-ups. We've tried med ball throws. The only thing we found in med ball throws is, untrained athletes, the more they do it, the better they get at the med ball throw, and
right,
it kind of throws off your validity. But just different exercise. But we found the snatch and the jump squat to work very well. And what I'll do is I'll do 2 sets of 4, and I'll take all 8 reps, and I'll take the peak power off of each one. I'll average that over the 8 reps and then put it against my best average, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best average of recent training times. You know, I'm not going to say, oh, in 1999 I did this.
Right.
What is in recent training times, where am I? And from that, what I will find is if I'm 95 to 100% of my recent best, and again, recent could be in the last macro cycle, you know, 4 to 6 to 8, you know, 8 weeks. It could be within a couple months. 95 to 100%, that makes me realize that my recovery is there, my nervous system is tuned up, and my innervation of my muscles, I'm just fired up, I'm ready to go. You know the days that you feel that, but it's nice to have objective measurement telling you. And if that's the case, I'm going to go with the speed day. And the speed will be whatever body parts I'm using that day. Usually I go with a upper body push, lower body pull combination, and then my next day will be upper body pull, lower body push. So those are my days, and I don't honestly know what exercises, rep schemes, or anything I'm doing before that day. I know I already have it written out what a speed, a max effort, and a rep day are going to be, but I don't know what it is until minutes before, because I want to make sure that my body's ready for that specific workout that day, not just, oh, it's Monday is speed bench day. Well, that doesn't make sense. Maybe I'm not recovered from a weight room I put in on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is if you push the nervous system too hard, that's usually the first thing to go.
Right.
And that's when your performance drops. And my concept of training is to get the most rest as possible in between each rep, each set, and each workout, and be as recovered as possible so your nervous system is most efficient as many times as you could tap into it. And the only way I've found to do that is by listening to my body through different tools such as the Tendo or different ways we've gone about it. I've done overhead shot put heaves. I've toyed with that. Found some pretty accurate results of that, but then again, because it is a technical movement, it is subject to, you know, if you're holding the shot put a little bit differently in your hand, you might get a better or worse result. And so I haven't found anything, honestly, as valid as the Tendo, although a standing broad jump, a vertical jump, some things like that might work as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So that's kind of where we've been. Going back to that, if I test out at 90 to 94%, that puts me at max effort work. I would just, whatever day it is, if it's upper body push, lower body pull, that means I'm probably going to do something like a bench, a push press, and maybe a power clean or a snatch high pull, something along those lines, those types of exercises. So then I know that's a max effort day, and I would hit some heavy doubles and singles of that type of exercise because I know my nervous system, my body's ready for it, because I've found that speed work takes more out of you and requires more than max effort work does.
I agree, and I think people tend to think the opposite because of the way.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just, you know.
But neurally, you're speaking, I think,
yes.
I completely agree. It's more technical, more coordinated oftentimes too, I think.
Sure. That's why, I mean, you don't get guys, you know, sprinting the world record all the time, but you get guys breaking the squat world record a lot.
Right.
You know, it's just a finer edge on that razor. So going back to, and then if I was to score 85 to 90%, we would use it as a rep day. That shows me my body, it's enough where I'm not overtrained, but I'm really not feeling it. It's just a good old fashioned work day, get some reps in. You know, that's your 5x5 days. That's your 3x8 days. That's your, you know, 4x6s, and just, or it could be your 3 sets of 20 in the squat and just get a bunch of work and get a big sweat going, a bunch of lactic acid built up, so you get your GPP up, and, you know, take it to the house. And after that, if I scored 84% or below, I know I'm on the verge of overtraining or getting injured. And another thing I've learned from training with the Russians and the Hungarians and a lot of the international athletes I've trained with, that being injured, you have no chance at all. So
right.
it's one of those things I think a lot of people overlook. My mindset is, if I'm undertrained, there's definitely a chance I could PR. If I'm overtrained, there's no chance. So if it ever comes up, I'm always going to err on the side of undertraining because I know I could recover from that. All I need is a little bit of work, and I'm better from that. And I look at my training, and I keep pretty close log, and I've never had a day where I've taken too many days off or rest, and it's affected me negatively. Mm-hmm. But I've had a number of days where I worked out one too many days and got injured and been out for 6 weeks.
Wow.
So I have to look at it as a betting man. If I'm to bet, which one am I going to bet on?
And that's an interesting concept because, I mean, I think our tendency is to just to want to push it in the gym at all costs.
Right.
And, that's probably a very American concept.
Of course.
But
it sounds as cool going home.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you don't tell your buddies, oh, man, it was great today. You know, I was tired and I went home, you know.
Exactly. Well, are you, what's your feeling on, like, assistance work then or auxiliary work? I mean, how much do you devote to that? Do you? And
yes, we do. And usually our core lifts are the ones we do with the speed max effort or the rep effort. And you know, I played with even the auxiliary work going along with the same components. We were doing speed auxiliary work. And usually we'll tone our workout where we'll have the big test, you know, obviously the warm-up. We'll warm up, we'll do the test, and then we'll go right into our core exercises, bang, 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 hit them. And then kind of our first auxiliary is going to be on the downslope of that speed intent or weight intent, down to kind of just turning things down almost in kind of an elongated cool down. That might just be because of me and I work out after work, so I don't want to be super amped when I leave because it's usually mm-hmm. 9 or 10 o'clock at night and I got to be here
right.
The next day. So that's how we've planned our workouts. I know it's worked really well for me. It's worked really well for Jason Lawson. He has a similar nervous system that I do. He seems to work really well off of hard work and then a lot of rest. And I'm talking, we're training 3 days a week. And people said, well, how can you be a professional Highland Games or professional strongman or you know, a high-end amateur strongman by 3 days a week? And it's just like, well, it comes down to you have to have a life, too. And
right.
You have to be able to hit it when you do. But what I've found for my nervous system and for my years of training, that if I hit it like I need to, the rest, I've almost scheduled my workout days around my rest days instead of vice versa.
That's a different concept than most people have upon their training.
Yeah, and that, when I started doing that about 2 years ago is when I started getting really good Highland Games. I started gaining weight. In 2006, I was 225 pounds. In 2007, I was 238 to 240. And I've been to 256 this year in 2008. And, yes, my body fat's gone up a little bit because you're not going to gain 30 pounds and not gain some body fat unless you're on drugs, which I'm not. So I have to come to that realization. But also my lifts have gone up and my throws have gone up considerably, which is the whole point, right?
Absolutely.
I haven't had any major injuries, knock on wood, because of it. And so, but it's been good. I've been able to compete at a pretty high level and have a lot of PRs. I mean, almost every game for 3 years I PR'd in something.
Well, so something must be working then.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like if I'm not getting hurt and I'm hitting PRs, then something's happening, right? And, again, it comes back to with me, I have to – the hardest part for me is to get out of the weight room and convince myself that I'm ready. And I think that's when so many athletes – that's where they fail – is thinking that they need to do that one more workout tomorrow. They need to get that one more set. And the hardest thing in the world is when you're on top of your game, walking away from it.
Right.
Because
and
everyone wants to push.
And that's hard, too, because I think a lot, you know, I'm sure you've seen this plenty of times, sporting coaches try to use the weight room as a mental toughness
right.
test, too.
Right.
And that can be often a problematic just for the reason that you're saying. You know, there's a time and a place for mental toughness training, but when you're doing – you know, you're trying to produce results like that. Obviously, what you're saying is you got to be a lot more cognizant of the impact that has.
You got to be. And you have to be honest with yourself of what level you are in your sport. You know,
mm-hmm.
When you're starting out, you need a whole bunch of reps. And, you know,
yeah.
And you need a whole lot of reps. You need a whole bunch. Yeah, that's when you need the volume work. But if you get, you know, on up there on the performance scale, it's not going to take the extreme amount of volume because if you do it, you're probably going to tear yourself apart. How many 1,000-pound squats can Donnie Thompson do? I don't know.
Right.
But I don't think it's, you know, two or three times a week, you know.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
And I know him pretty well, and he goes heavy, you know, from time to time, and obviously that's part of his training. But when you're, you know, but if you're only squatting 225, then yeah, you could do it all the time if you want, because it's such a lower potential of what your body's capable of. So I think that's the thing that people need to take into account. I think that's where a lot of Americans actually miss it. They're afraid to walk out of training and not just be lazy. And you, that's where you have to be honest with yourself. Are you just being lazy and skipping out on a workout, or is it a planned rest period that, you know, the rest is as important as the work, and that people just have to realize that it's the eating is just as important as the working out. I mean, you got to be able to recover. If you can't recover, then the work you're doing, you're just putting yourself in a hole. So I think that people just need to realize that more than just about anything. The work is super important, but on the flip side, so is the recovery. And if you're not giving yourself a chance for that, you're just asking. I mean, your days are numbered at that point.
Well, and it's interesting too, because you mentioned something interesting that, you know, I think sometimes the average person tries to apply principles that elite athletes use, and obviously
right.
It's not applicable.
Right.
It's always kind of funny. Like, I better take the day off. I squat really heavy, you know, and 135 could be heavy. And you guys seem to have made a move towards more of a, you know, getting your feet wet, more wet, maybe is the accurate statement, in the fitness community with your development and things like the base fit rack system and
right.
Some other components. You know, someone who's starting a fitness program, how does your philosophy differ? What's your, you know, if you were to, I know you don't train a lot of people, but if you were to get people that were interested in starting up a workout program, what's your sort of general philosophy, where to begin?
Well, and that's interesting. Again, I think it comes down to the initial evaluation of where that athlete is. And maybe you can't self-diagnose as well, because either people are going to think they're a lot higher or a lot worse than they actually are. So you need a trained professional there to tell you, you know, really where you are, and you have to be able to watch the athlete. But I think at that point it turns out to be you got to pile on the volume. You know, conversely, now I know this goes right against what I just said, but when they're first starting out, I think you need to pile on the volume, because their body needs to get used to the work, and there's a lot of changes that need to be made psychologically as well as physically. And they just need to get the volume. They need to get under the bar and get the volume up. I've subscribed to the idea that you don't really get hurt too often when you're weak. and really, it's the case. It's, you know, you always get hurt when you're redlining and when you're your best shape. Which, strangely enough, that's why when I'm peaking for an event or my training is going exceptionally well, I'm really excited, but 50% of that is I'm nervous, because I know I'm the closest to getting injured that I'll probably be, because I know I'm redlining it. I know everything's running smooth, but I know I'm running hot. And that's
right.
When I had, like last week, I had to intentionally back off my training, because I had like six practices in a row with practice PRs. And
wow.
What that tells me is, yes, I'm ready for Worlds right now, but how ready am I going to be in 3 weeks? And
sure.
Am I going to be injured in 3 weeks if I try to make it 8 days in a row? So, and these weren't days I was really going after. It was just the training clicked, and it was going, and it was building, and it was like this big crescendo was building. But I have to realize, you know, walking that close, I liken it to a cliff or a peak of a mountain. Yes, you're going to get to that peak, but what's on the other side of it? That's the cliff. And
right.
So you could go up and take a nice look off that cliff. But at some point, you need to back off, because you're only going to walk that line for so long. And that's what I think people need to realize. And that just comes back to that planned rest and the planned recovery methods.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but, you know, I think the movement in a lot of the strength training is to do more and, you know, more days. So, you know, what is good volume? How's the obviously, you're advanced. So you know your body. You know when
right.
You need to rest. But how does someone who's sort of an intermediate beginner type sort of make the same judgment call?
Sure. Well, that's I'll hate to say it, but that's when in many cases the professional comes in, like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of these guys and girls, they don't know what really hard work feels like. They don't know the difference between "ow, I'm sore" and "ow, I'm injured." And that just comes with years and years of doing it. I honestly think when you start out, I think you need to be at least 3 days a week. You need to be pounding it. You need to be doing a lot of basic multi-jointed exercises and doing 2 to 3 times the volume that an elite level guy is doing. And because you're not going to be using a lot of weight, but you're needing to, you need to pound it, you know, and you need to get it done, because psychologically also you're going to see, well, you're going to see results faster, which psychologically is going to keep you coming back. And I think that's what a problem that a lot of trainers make with their athletes, or not necessarily athletes, but clients. They take it so easy on them in the first 3 to 4 weeks that the client doesn't see any change. They grow tired of it because of the novelty is worn off. They've never been worked really hard. Their body hasn't changed significantly, so they quit. So it's kind of a double-edged sword in many cases, because you haven't really got anything out of the person. Conversely, I know how my father, Richard, has trained a lot of people, you know, after he knows that they're safe and understand the techniques, but he'll also scale it where the easiest technique possible, he'll just pound them on the volume. And you learn so much faster and you get so much fitter so fast that eventually you're there. You're there a lot quicker than you would think, and the person is happy. They've lost some weight, or their arms have gotten bigger, or, you know, name something. And then they're sold on the plan, and then, you know, those are the guys that are hard to keep out of the weight room after that.
And, yeah, because I remember I met a guy at your open house that trained with your dad, and I think, unfortunately, I don't remember the gentleman's name. I think he lost 70 pounds, and
yes,
his lifts were quite impressive.
Yes, a fellow named Greg, and the funny part was, he lost right at 70 pounds, and the first day he was in here, he got on the elliptical. They told him to warm up for 5 minutes just to move, you know, just get some blood moving. And he was a comic book artist, so he sat down for 16 hours a day for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And he almost fell off the elliptical and claimed to God that it was impossible to go for 2 minutes on the elliptical, that no person should be able to go for 5 minutes. Well, less than a year later, he went for an hour and 58 minutes straight.
Wow.
And, you know, so, and then he ended up going, that first week he couldn't, he could not do a free weight squat with a 15-pound aluminum bar, and ended up a year or a year and a half later did 450 on a safety squat bar.
That's incredible.
So, yeah, it's amazing. I'm thinking, God, if I what would I do for results like that right now?
Yeah, no kidding.
So, and it was awesome, and the guy could do all types of stuff now. I mean, he's, you know, benching over a good bit over 225 and lost all kinds of weight, you know, and for just a, you know, an average guy, that's some really good numbers, you know, and especially for the improvement that he had made. And he's not a young guy; he's 50 years old.
Right, and that's the thing. You know, I'm sure you've seen it plenty of times. I mean, your dad was. I mean, I think my jaw dropped for the first time in a while when your dad walked up to the bar at your open house and deadlifted 405 with like one hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no warm up. It wasn't
right,
like he was
right.
Warming up. You know, I thought he was just sort of placing his hand down for a moment. And your dad's how old?
58.
I think most people would think 35-year-olds shouldn't be able to deadlift 405, more or less 58-year-olds with one hand.
Right, right. Well, and that comes in for the last, you know, that's 40, that's about 50 years of volume there, too.
Right.
Felt like, you know, a Louis Simmons or someone like that just doesn't know any other way. And that's where the volume comes in. And, you know, I've talked to my dad a lot of times, and, you know, and I'll be honest, in many cases, it's hard for him now to throttle that back, because he's been pushing it so hard for so long. Taking those rest days is even a little bit foreign for him still, because he's been able to just tough it out for so long. And, you know, once you get to 58, you know, your squat goes down a little bit. And so, you know, on his 58th birthday, he still went 405 for five, which is nice. But it was still, it's kind of funny, you know, and he's thinking, well, why isn't this going for 20 anymore? And I'm just like, well, you know,
yeah.
So but it's kind of goes back to the philosophy that if no one ever told you how old you are, how old would you be? And
right.
It's kind of funny, and he basically hangs out with all the kids and the athletes in here in this place, and we got some studs, and that's pretty much what he measures himself. You know, you measure yourself against Tex or Jason Cyborg Lawson, and you know, you kind of have a different perspective. So segueing into something else, the folks you train with makes a huge difference. and just the atmosphere that you're around and the training system that you're around, that's an enormous difference. And because you get that same guy, Greg, if he would have gone to a potentially another gym and they would have had him doing really, you know, kind of sissy little lifting stuff, he wouldn't have lost the weight, he wouldn't have gotten strong, and his life wouldn't have changed.
Well, and I have a good friend who still claims that the best aspect of Westside Barbell is training at Westside Barbell.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wholeheartedly agree. I have not – I've trained there a few times. I mean, I wouldn't say that I was a guy who trained at Westside, you know, day in, day out, but I have – lifted there a number of times with Louie, and yeah, I can understand how guys can get really strong in there. And yeah, the atmosphere I think is the number one thing.
So you guys, you know, this has been awesome because it's a lot of, you know, when you're in the trenches, you learn so much more than just sitting back on the keyboard making theories up, which happens a lot nowadays.
Sure.
But you guys have some really, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the cool equipment because, you know, we recently got the BaseFit system. It's the BaseFit one, right? The
yes.
series.
Yes, you got the BaseFit. I think you got a triple or maybe even a quad. I can't remember.
And you know, if someone wants to start like a home gym, it's kind of a weird question, but you know, you guys have some pretty phenomenal equipment that could rival some. You could rival in your home gym some very elite training centers. Where would you start with, like, let's say, a home gym, for example?
Well, you first have to look at what the person is looking to accomplish. It's kind of like saying, what would you say that needs to be in someone's wardrobe? Well, are they going to be working construction? Or are they going to be going to black tie dinners? You have to figure that out first. And it just depends. Are you looking to be a MMA fighter, CrossFit kind of guy? Or are you looking to be a powerlifter, Olympic lifter, an athlete, whatever it may be? So you got to look at that first. But everything, you know, I would say, and you would probably agree, all comes back to multi-jointed ground-based activities, i.e. squats, deadlifts, pulls of some sort of an Olympic lifting nature, push presses, bench presses, inclines, rows, chin-ups. And you're basically, those are your basics, and you would just want to be able to accommodate those things. Now, you could go with something like a BaseFit rack that's very simple, very Spartan, and get a lot of work done. If you're one of those guys that likes to tinker a little bit more and really tweak out your training as much as possible, or if you're a bigger guy using bigger weights, maybe something like the base camp rack is better because you're going to have 1,140 holes in that rack to decide what you want to do with it.
Right. So, and it's pretty. And you guys are pretty creative with the ones that from the videos you guys have online. You know, people can check them out on YouTube. It's pretty amazing what you guys come up with.
But it's a labor of love, and like you said, I mean, we're athletes, and we don't have really research development sessions planned at our business. It's you know, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, we go and lift, and we're playing, we're making stuff up, we're trying things out, and that's our R&D session because a lot of things work on paper, but
right.
Until you get under the bar and strap some weight or some bands or chains or things that have never been strapped on a bar before to see what it does and see what it does to your body and to see what it does in the training. And that's, again, where the journals come in to see, well, what was happening here when we were trying this? Oh, okay, this worked really good. Or, okay, it didn't work bad. It didn't work at all. And that's, you got to be honest with yourself, not just throw a bunch of stuff out. You got to say, okay, this didn't work at all, or I got injured, and we don't need that. So, That's where you just got to come down to. But we've had a ball. Jeff Gergen is in our stable now, and he's helping out a ton here, and he's been great to help us with different ideas. And he has a background as a collegiate strength coach at the University of Miami as well as UTEP. UTEP. And so he was, you know, been around and got to train under guys like Coach Tommy Moffitt and some different coaches like that have definitely had a successful career. And so I get the benefit of hearing more about the internal workings of a great program like Miami or LSU's had. So,
well, and I have to compliment you because, I mean, that some of the stuff you guys have been coming out with is awesome. And I have to still shoot you that video, but, you know, as someone who deals with a lot of fitness individuals primarily, and we do get some athletes, but on the younger end, I mean, that BaseFit system is just, I mean, I can't imagine how you don't start with that. You know, for someone who wants to be a fitness professional and deal with some athletes, you know, it's, and for those that don't know and haven't seen the website, basically, maybe you could explain briefly, there's two different options, but you've got to come up with something pretty creative, maybe go a little deeper detail of the thought process and what you guys made out of it.
Well, pretty much, it just comes down to it. It's like an erector set for lifters. It could be made in any different. It's a squat rack or Olympic type rack with a series of chin up bars, and everything is ultimately customizable by the customer. So it could fit any room you put it in. You could put it in any configuration for that specific athlete type or size. So you could set it where it's set up for all kids sizes. So it really comes down to, you know, what can you do with an erector set, or what can you do with a set of Legos? Well, just about anything. And that's kind of the idea that the base fit is built off of. And really, we're having more and more military folks really interested in it, because they could easily package them. They could ship them overseas to Iraq for the soldiers over there right now. They could set them up. If they got to move tomorrow, you take 2 3/4-inch wrenches, knock it down, throw it on a pallet, move it 50 miles, set it up again. And so it's really neat how it works, and it could be as big or as small as you want it to be, and it could be, you could spend as little or as much as you want to on it. So I think you're right, as a starting situation for a training center, that should be one of the meat and potatoes, because you're always, even if it's not going to be your main rack that you use, you're always going to need an auxiliary station. I've found that to be the case here in our training center. We have base camp racks. We have a number of other of our rack and more collegiate style training systems, but still we have people on the base fit daily, I mean all the time, because it's just a great station that doesn't take up much space, and it's not real expensive, and it's just kind of like a Swiss Army knife. You're going to use it, you know.
Absolutely.
It's never a bad idea to have it around, you know.
Well, and you know, the trend in the fitness industry is to go more groups, because, I mean, let's face it, I mean, personal training is one of the few industries where things are one-on-one. And, you know, while you could definitely use the rack in a one-on-one situation, it's great. You could do, I think, you know, anywhere, you know, 2 or 3 people, and we've counted up to almost 15 that you could station at that thing if you set up correctly. And,
I mean, it's working for you guys.
Yeah, well, we're milking it for all it's worth.
Well, it's more billable hours for those that are interested in, you know, making a business of it. Let's just be honest. If you're in the business of owning a training facility and you're a trainer, you got to get people through the door if you're going to keep your rent going. And you got to eat, you know. And if there's
Absolutely.
Only so many hours a day, and it's just how it goes. Either in order to make money, you're either going to have to charge your clients more or get more clients to the door. That's how it goes. It's economics. And so if you could give a very quality experience to your clients and get more of them through the door, well, then that enables you to build a better facility, you know, and service your clients even better.
And the great part, too, is, I mean, we've had as young as 10 and as old as 70 on there. So,
cool.
You know, it's something that, you know, obviously is very versatile, and it's not just for the elite athlete or anything of that nature. So it's a great piece. And something else you guys are probably really well known for is obviously the landmine.
That's been a best-selling piece of all time. And the funny part about that was I never made it with the intent to sell it. And that was in 1999. I was training for the upcoming 2000 Olympic trials for the hammer throw. And I honestly, my dad and I kind of designed it, and just for something to help me with my rotational strength. I trained on it for a few months, showed it to a couple coaches. They loved it. They asked me to build one for them. I said, well, I mean, I'm in the equipment building business. Why wouldn't I build you one, you know? So we've started making them. I don't even know the numbers of them we've sold, but it seems like everyone's either has a knockoff of one now or different licensing, and it's kind of funny. It's for something that we didn't even intend to sell, turned out to be our best-selling piece of all time. I think that's going to be eclipsed by the base fit, just because it's so versatile, but it's still, the landmine holds a special place in my heart, because that was one of my first babies, and it really, really hit the training world, and I'm excited to know that it's changed, in many cases, changed training to a lot of rotational, weight-loaded exercises, whereas before, the most people were doing rotation-wise was maybe some med ball twists or some throws. Whereas, you know, I know the Atlanta Falcons, I watched them down there. They were training with the landmine with the combat handles on there. Anything over 25 pounds is really heavy. That's hard on there. And they were doing a 25-kilo or 55-pound plate, touching the floor each side. I'm thinking, wow, you know, that is really, really strong. And, you know, you wouldn't have seen that, I don't think, 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Well, as you mentioned, I mean, it's more than just, you know, the rotation development, too. I mean, a client of mine just sent me a video from Michigan State football and how they're implementing it with some different pushing drills. I mean, there's a whole host of you've probably come up with hundreds of exercises, I imagine, that you can do with the implement.
Yeah, we've come up with a ton, but the what I like even better is that I have customers and clients coming back to me telling me, this is what we've done with it, you know. It's like, wow, that blows my mind. That's a great idea. You know, the combat handles, they were the idea of Al Miller, the Falcons. I mean, the guy has a number of Super Bowl rings. He's been in a ton of different teams, been around forever, coached under Bear Bryant, and he came up with a football handle. He said, you need to make something that does this. And it's like, that's genius. That's our best-selling handle we've ever had for it. And, you know, it's called the combat handle now, but it was originally the football handle. Then really a lot of the MMA and the wrestlers and the hockey players and everyone else that fights, they started buying them. And then all of a sudden it just really cranked off. And it was really cool to see, because almost every coach that I talk to has come up with something different to do with his landmine. It's like, man, that's great. And you could throw them in your trunk and you could go right down the road and train somewhere else. And so I used to carry one in the back of my SUV, because I was traveling so much training, and that was before every gym around had them, that I wanted to make sure I had mine when I trained.
Yeah, well, my good friend Alan Cosgrove showed me a version he was doing where he uses it to teach the front squat to people, you know, very early beginning fitness people, and it sort of forces you into the correct position, especially, you know, people that are limited and, you know, wrist flexibility and so forth that can't handle a bar.
Sure.
It was a pretty cool idea. Because it just sort of puts you right there.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've had even going from a standing press position down into a front squat, holding the front squat position, you know, one-armed, bring the bar down and pressing it back up for stability, and then standing back up an overhead squat. So things like that. I mean, and I've watched, you know, 120-pound girls in here do that, and just you talk about getting fit. There's so much stability, so much strength that's going on. And, you know, these are, you know, young, attractive women who wouldn't be caught dead in the weight room 10 years before.
Right.
But they're in here training their butts off, doing some pretty high-end exercises. And because it falls in that category of it's not scary, it's not intimidating, and then obviously once they get comfortable with it, you can start going pretty heavy and going pretty hard and having some amazing results.
Well, and it seems like you guys have been on the cutting edge too. You know, you realize that this strongman type training is, you know, increasingly getting more popular. And you know, something I keep bugging you about is that dang yoke. And that's just a sweet, cool piece of equipment, and really applicable, I think, you know, for people that, you know, could be in a home gym setting, or people that aren't in a sports performance or fitness training. Because I mean, people want sleds, they want a chin up bar, they want a squat rack, they want, you know, place to store things. Maybe you could just talk about a little bit of the development of that.
Sure. That actually came, again, from our good buddy Jeff Gergen, who works with us. And he used to do strongman training, and he used to compete against Don Pope and Jesse Marunde a good bit when they were all amateurs. And before he had an injury, he was doing pretty well with that. But what I was talking to him, we were making a yoke for a customer, and the customer wanted just a big heavy-duty yoke. And so, okay, that's great. And so Jeff and I started talking, and he told me, he said, well, I made a yoke that actually doubled as a power rack. And we started talking about just how genius of an idea that is, because with the price of steel these days, why would you have something that could only be used for one thing if the steel and the basic dimensions are the same? And because anyone who's doing strongman also has to squat, they have to bench, they have to push press. So why should they buy a power rack as well as a yoke, when a yoke can only be used as one thing?
Right.
And it always costs a lot of money, because people don't mass produce them. They're usually a custom option, a custom piece, and, you know, they're going to cost over $1,000. Whereas if you could slightly change that yoke, it could be used for a lot of things. So when we were designing this fella's yoke, we put our heads together and brought Dad in the room, and we all started talking about, okay, well, if I was a strongman training and I was training out of my garage, what would I want my yoke to have? And we just kept, you add something and you go, well, heck, that works for that too. And then after a while, we came up with something that could be used as a, is a bench press, as a squat rack, as a pull-up bar, as a yoke, obviously, a Conan's walk. Has band compatibility, so you could do band work if you're one of those guys that do powerlifting and strongman. By having pins on there to hold the weights for when you're yoke walking, it has automatically built-in plate storage, and it has six different pins, so you got all types of places where you could load and balance the piece out. Then if it's going to have, obviously it has to sit on the ground, well, why not make it have sled feet, so now you can make a push or a pull sled.
And right.
So it just kept kind of growing into, you know, the solution. We looked at it more as a solution, not as a, this is a piece of equipment, but as, you know, if I was a strong man right now and I had to have one piece, what would it be? And we just tried to cover as many bases as possible, because we realized the money, you know, money's tight right now with the economy and the steel prices are high. And if you could have one piece that doesn't take up your whole garage, and you could do a lot of training off of it, that has to be a lot better than what's currently available.
And you know, I think people look at the price and sometimes they miss the point that, you know, I paid probably more in one of my power racks that can do, you know, a couple of things than this thing that could be about six pieces of equipment that if you bought separately, probably would be about $5,000.
Sure.
Oh, absolutely. If you added up everything.
And then you got to store it. You got to have it. You got to have it somewhere. You got to know how to adjust it. And if you ever wanted to, say, run a contest, then you have to move a whole tractor trailer worth of stuff, whereas with the yoke, you just throw it in the back of a pickup truck, it breaks down, and we've done stone loads with it. We've done box jumps with it. So you could really, you could run a lot of events off in a strongman contest, or at least train for them, with one piece of equipment. And being in a sport like Highland Games, where I know the implements and the equipment are really where it gets difficult, having all that stuff. And that's why I'm actually working on a piece of equipment right now. It's just a little simple thing, but it's for people who, if they want to get into Highland Games, they could buy one little piece, and it covers about seven or eight of the events.
Oh, wow.
Because gives you, instead of saying, well, I got to buy a hammer, a heavy hammer, a light hammer, a heavyweight, a lightweight, a, you know, name something, or a weight over bar, you have all this stuff where maybe if you could buy one piece, load the plates on it, it adjusts to make a lot of different things, and a guy that wants to start out, or even a guy who wants an adjustable weight to do his training, could buy one thing, and or if he wants to travel somewhere, he'd take one piece with him, and you could get 90% of your Highland Games training done the same, you know, with just some adjustments. And I think that's really what it's coming down to. People that are multi-sport athletes need to be able to be as efficient as possible. You know, if you're a world record holder or something like that, yeah, you need to buy the best shot put out there. But if you're a guy that's going to throw a shot put every once in a while, then you need to have something that could double for another piece of equipment as well, in my opinion.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, and we get a lot of, you know, high school coaches and youth coaches, too, that, you know, right, to ask us, you know, equipment again. It's amazing that they'll spend a lot of money on something like a jammer when they could
right.
buy some of the equipment you guys are producing, and they could train, you know, so many more kids and get so many more athletes involved. And it looks like we just have some more good stuff to look forward to from you guys.
Well, it is funny, and it really just comes down to the education level of the person. I don't mean this by a formal education, but what they understand about the equipment and what they understand is possible, and just thinking a little bit out of the box and realizing, yes, for this amount of money you could have 10 things, or for $50 less you could have one.
Right.
And in my opinion, it's a really simple equation. But it just takes people with an open mind to look at it and realize the reality of training, and that you have to be able to get a number of things done with a piece of equipment, simply because these days, with especially in the college market, with the NCAA rules that allow only a certain amount of time in the weight room, you can't have three benches, three squat racks. You got to have a lot of different things if you're going to get the volume of athletes through the training center without creating bottlenecks. And that's the thing that I think people are missing, is the flow of a weight room has to work. It has to be like a river. You can't have parts that are dammed up. If you have 10 squat racks and two glute hams, I almost think you should not even have glute hams. Because
right.
you're going to have 50 kids in about 30 minutes that need to do two glute hams.
Right.
And you're just going to create an enormous bottleneck, and that's when, you know, you got guys walking around and, and horseplay and all everything, your whole workout momentum ends. So in my opinion, things as far as from a college or an institutional weight room setup, your auxiliary exercises and pieces need to be 25% minimum, 50 to 75% maximum of what your core exercise pieces are. If not, I think you will create bottlenecks.
Yeah, and that's a huge point for special athletic directors and those developing budgets and coaches that are looking for the best stuff. So, you know, I want to thank you so much. This has been awesome. I knew it was going to be very cool, and it definitely was. So I appreciate your time. And if people want to contact you guys, because you guys do make custom you know, equipment, you know, if they have a specific need, what's the best way to get a hold of you guys?
They could just go to sorinex.com. That's www.sorinex.com. And they could contact us right from there. Our emails are on there. Our phone numbers are on there. We have toll-free numbers. So that's probably the best way they could do it. And they could at least check out and see what we have to offer first. So so they would, you know, I hate to say it, but so they ask the right questions, because my goal is to help the customer as much as possible and consult them. But if they have no idea of what we have available, sometimes we can't get to that level of understanding quick enough. So really just look around, watch some of the videos, get familiarize yourself with what we have to offer, and then we would love to help you. But there's just a lot of new ideas that I know people wouldn't have not seen before. And, you know, before you spend your money, look around a little bit. That's all I could really suggest. You know, an educated customer is a better customer, because they're going to get closer to what they want. Don't settle for the first thing you see.
Well, thank you again. And, you know, I just want to emphasize, too, you know, one of the reasons that we had you on here was it's the same equipment that, you know, we like to use and we're going to get more of in our facility. So it's not just, you know, trying to promote someone. It's the stuff that we believe in. So thank you so much again, Bert, and I really appreciate
your time.
Thank you, Josh.
It's been a true pleasure. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you so much. And this is Josh Hankin from Sandbag Fitness Systems. Check out sorinex.com. And thanks again to Bert Sorin and all the great guys over there. And we'll look forward to talking to you some more.
Thanks, Josh.